Hello? It's loud even. Well, Chris and I have known each other for about 27 years, and I feel I have a right to be up here because I've gotten to watch her journey. And we are very blessed this morning. Oh, you can't hear me? That's amazing. I'm not silent. We are blessed to hear a very amazing story this morning. And I guess what I hope that we'll all take out of here is a real sense of how important it is to be willing to go to any lengths and to be really clear that we want recovery and don't want disease. And it appears to me those are the two critical things. And Chris is going to be a little dramatic. She couldn't just settle with her story. She had to spend the last week coming up with a phenomenal example of both of those. So we'll forgive her for being a little extra dramatic about this. So anyway, I would like to introduce Chris C.
In my typical fashion, I forgot something. We're passing around a folder that is a picture of Chris. You can see how she looks now. A picture of Chris when she was at a low point in her disease. It's an alarming picture. If you feel like it's going to bother you, please don't look at it. Okay?
One more editorial. That picture does not look as powerful as Chris looked when she opened the door.
So how do I do this, Marlene?
Just oh, stick you put it in there and it just goes up, but you gotta be close to the mic or it doesn't pick you up.
Sorry. Wow, this is a huge meeting. I love this. Hi, I'm Chris. I'm a recovering compulsive eater, anorexic, and bulimic, and I'm delighted to be with you today to share my story. Can everybody hear me okay? Thank you. I'd like to begin by talking a little bit about my family of origin. I was born and raised in Chicago. Both of my parents were excellent cooks, and family gatherings always involved a lot of great food and plenty of alcohol. My father was an alcoholic, and my mother suffered from bipolar and schizophrenia diseases in her early 40s. In our family, it was really important to look good to the outside world, even though there was chaos at home. I was born with spina bifida, which involved surgeries on my spine at age 2, and which caused renal failure at age 5. Because of the spina bifida, I've had numerous other surgeries, which have produced issues with what I can eat. For instance, in my 30s, I needed to have all but 8 inches of my colon removed, and I was fed by IV. After those surgeries, I needed to be extremely careful with food choices that I made due to a high incidence of small bowel obstructions. This is just one example of how my health brings up issues with food and makes abstinence harder to achieve. This past Monday, I was admitted to Providence Portland Medical Center with a fever of 103 degrees and a nasty kidney infection that I haven't been able to shake for several months. Before going to ER, I experienced severe shaking because of the fever and bouts of nausea. I knew I had to keep food in me, otherwise the nausea would just get worse. It took me an hour to eat a half sandwich, but I did it. One of the many things this program has taught me is that my eating disorder is always lurking in the shadows, just waiting to catch me at a weak moment. Thanks to the grace of my higher power, I didn't succumb to it. I began OA in 1991, based upon my counselor's recommendations after several years of struggling with the food. I restricted when hungry, I stole food, spent excessive amounts of money on junk food, binged in isolation, practiced exercise bulimia, and found myself wallowing in guilt, shame, and remorse. I distinctly remember driving home one evening after working swing shift at a local hospital. I stopped for binge foods at my usual places on the way home and decided to pull into the parking lot of a park. I ignored the signs that said the park was closed and started to binge. Just then, a police officer pulled up next to me and peered into my car with a bright flashlight. To my utter horror, he saw all of the empty food wrappers on the front seat and the floor of the car. Thankfully, no citation was issued that night, but he told me to move along. I felt immense shame and embarrassment as I pulled away. That's one night I hope to never forget. While in Chicago, I would describe my program as weak. I sat in the back at meetings and didn't say anything. I didn't have a sponsor, and I became hung up on the name Overeaters Anonymous because I was an undereater. I sat in judgment. I didn't feel like I fit in because I made no effort to do so. I wasn't getting recovery because I wasn't willing to work the program. As a result of practicing the disease, I was not thinking clearly. My perspective was way off. Then I moved from Chicago to Portland in 1992, and I weighed between 100 and 110 pounds, and I'm 5'4". Excuse me. I was practicing my disease daily by restricting, binging, and exercising too much in order to lose weight, or practicing exercise bulimia. I drank huge quantities of water, which washed out my electrolytes. I didn't eat enough to feed my brain or my body. It was very difficult to think clearly back then, and I was filled with fear. I remember calling my sponsor because I couldn't decide between a potato or a yam for dinner, and which felt like a major crisis, and I'm not exaggerating. I also remember calling my OA sponsor after binging, and she would consistently ask me if I had eaten enough before the binge. I would often get defensive and avoid answering any questions about quantities of food that I had consumed. Looking back, I see a connection between my restricting and binging behavior, even though I wasn't able to recognize it at the time. I continued this behavior for about a year and a half. I couldn't drive because I didn't trust myself to be safe behind the wheel, as it was difficult to focus and maintain my concentration. It would have been irresponsible for me to drive because of my slow reaction time, experiencing moments of disorientation, and having a general state of spaciness. I was barely able to hold down a job. I was college educated and working in a mailroom sorting mail. My fellow employees would get angry because I was so slow at processing the mail. I don't remember if I was fired from that job, though I had been fired from a job in Chicago because of my inability to keep up with the work. One day, on the way home from work, I fainted when getting off the bus. All I remember is seeing spots and waking up to several people standing around me. It was June 1994, so the weather was warm, and I was wearing a heavy winter coat because I was so cold all the time. My hands and feet were always like ice, regardless of the weather. Excuse me. I remember reaching the house where I was renting a room. The home was owned by the parents of a dear OA friend. They too had tried to get me to eat more. All I remember is loading up a tray with glasses of water and trudging up the stairs to my room. I would have to pause halfway up the staircase because I experienced severe shortness of breath. I really didn't care what was going to happen to me that day. All I remember thinking is that I wanted to sleep for a really long time, and I was numb to the reality of my situation, which was pretty dire. I wasn't earning enough money to make ends meet. I couldn't afford to buy the food that I needed. When I did buy the food, I didn't eat it. I had no health insurance, and I owed thousands of dollars on student loans. It seemed that everyone in my life was trying to get me to eat more, but I was convinced that that was not the problem. Then, unbeknownst to me, my OA friend and her mom notified my sponsor about my fainting episode and their concerns about my not surviving the weekend. That weekend, my sponsor showed up at the door where I was, and showed up at the house where I was renting a room. I don't think I'll ever forget the look of shock and concern that I saw on her face. We hadn't seen each other in several weeks because I had fired her and stopped going to meetings. My sponsor asked if I would be willing to go to the emergency room that day, and I begrudgingly agreed. The disease was telling me that I could still control the results, but some part of me knew I needed help. At the ER, I tried to convince the doctor that I would start eating again if he discharged me, but he saw right through that. My sponsor also informed the ER doctor about her absolute belief that I wouldn't eat after I was discharged. By this time, I had restricted to the point of weighing 69 pounds, and it actually hurt to eat food. I was admitted to the hospital, committed, and became a ward of the state because I was considered a harm to myself. I was fed by a tube that went from my nose to my stomach. I stayed in the hospital for over a month while I slowly gained enough weight to be eligible for an outpatient eating disorders treatment program. While in the hospital, I remember throwing trays of food on the floor several times. I had become really agitated and was yelling at the staff that they were trying to kill me with the food. I was so out of my mind that I actually believed that. One of the nurses told me that if my tirade continued, I would need to be tied down. I had seen my mom restrained in a psych unit, and I knew I didn't want that for myself. So I made a decision to cooperate with the staff and not fight them anymore, which wasn't easy for me to do. I was discharged from the hospital at 89 pounds and placed in a foster home. Life in the foster home was very challenging for me. My disease swung the other way, and I started binging on food even after I had eaten my meals for the day. I remember hopping on a bus one day and heading downtown to a goodie store. I bought a bunch of goodies and headed back to the foster home with the intention of binging. While on the bus ride home, I had a moment of sanity and asked for help from my higher power. I remember getting off the bus and going into a church where I knew an AA meeting was being held. I dropped the bags of goodies on the table and told the AA members that I needed them to take it away, otherwise I was going to kill myself with it. There I was, sobbing uncontrollably and asking for help from total strangers. They took the goodies away, sat me down, and invited me to stay for the meeting. That day, I learned the power of asking for help. I practiced all three of my diseases at the foster home. I would restrict, binge, and then exercise excessively. Then I attended an outpatient eating disorders treatment program. While in treatment, I learned how to eat full meals and not restrict, renewed my relationships with my sponsor, and returned to OA meetings. Sadly, some of the people that I met in treatment are no longer with us because of this deadly disease. The one thing that I did consistently throughout this time in my life and since then is ask for help from a power greater than myself. I never stopped praying. I have recordings of my prayer and meditation sessions from the 1990s where I pleaded with my higher power to take away this disease and asked for the willingness to work the OA program. From childhood on, I had a sense of connection with a higher power. The focus has changed as time has gone on, but the belief was always there. I dabbled in various religions and called my higher power different names over the years. My experiences with different religions was relatively positive, but I became confused and disillusioned by all the rules or the dogma that were part of the package deal. Then I heard a speaker at a 12-step meeting suggest that the group could represent the higher power. I liked that idea and chose to adopt it for a while. Now I incorporate a little bit of everything from various sources, and that works for me. During my time in OA, I have worked the steps with a sponsor, gone to meetings, performed service work, sponsored members, and applied the steps in my daily life, especially steps 10, 11, and 12. When I do the 10th step, I examine my fears and resentments and my part in them. It's important that I keep my side of the street clean, so to speak, and not let the fears and resentments build up. I often end up praying for the person who I feel has done me harm, because that's what it says to do in the big book. Based on my experience, that works. For step 11, I start my day by connecting with my higher power through prayer and meditation. While performing yoga poses in the morning, I check in with higher power and express gratitude for the many wonderful people in my life. Throughout the day, I often pause when agitated and doubtful and ask for the right thought or action, just like it says in the big book. However, my favorite way of interacting with a power greater than myself is by being in nature. That's where I get inspired. When I'm in the great outdoors, I can feel the stress just slip away, and I'm rejuvenated again. Regarding step 12, I am very active in my home meeting. I talk with newcomers and I sponsor people. I'm currently seeing a professional counselor for mental health issues and to check in about my eating. I have also committed to go to any lengths to keep my weight up, which is now 143 pounds. Thank you. I am terrified of sliding backwards and going back to that awful way of living where everything was a struggle. Today, food is not the center of my universe. My higher power is. I plan my meals on a daily basis, and I go on with my life. I pray and meditate daily. I focus on gratitude for the many blessings in my life, which include a wonderful significant other, a lovely home, and a sweet kitty named Opus. My health is greatly improved since I stopped practicing my eating disorders. I am able to walk and hike several miles now without shortness of breath. I have rich relationships with my sponsor, friends, and family members. Through the grace of my higher power and a whole lot of footwork, I have recently completed a graduate school program and graduated with a Master's of Science in Speech Therapy. Grad school was tough. Oh my. There were many times when I wanted to throw in the towel. On a daily basis, I would have to pray for the willingness to keep on keeping on. Fear plagued me. The chatter in my head was relentless. I compared myself to my younger fellow classmates often, and I always lost. I needed constant encouragement from my sponsor and other members of my cheering section. They reminded me that if I just focused on doing the footwork and leave the results up to my higher power, then I'd be okay. Like my significant other often reminds me, I'm not in control. Frankly, I was fearful of falling behind in my studies, and I was terrified of falling back into my eating disorder. And miraculously, as I continued to work my program, I did not practice my eating disorder. Thanks to the gifts of this program, I am living on life's terms, one day at a time. Now I'd like to read a few passages from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, 4th edition. I recently went to an OA speakers meeting and heard the speakers read from the chapter More on Alcoholism, which can be found on page 30. This chapter clearly illustrates the insanity which is at the core of our disease. In your minds, please replace the word alcohol with food and alcoholic with compulsive eater. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to finally concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently may be, has to be smashed. Here are some of the methods that we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever, with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums, and the list goes on. I'd like to end this talk by sharing one of my favorite passages from the Big Book, fourth edition. The chapter, Acceptance Was the Answer, can be found on page 407. At last, acceptance proved to be the key to my drinking problem. After I had been around AA for 7 months, tapering off alcohol and pills, not finding the program working very well, I was finally able to say, okay, God, it is true. That I, of all people, strange as it may seem, and even though I didn't give my permission, really, really am an alcoholic of sorts. And it's all right with me. Now, what am I going to do about it? When I stopped living in the problem and began living in the answer, the problem went away. From that moment on, I have not had a single compulsion to drink. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, or thing, or situation as being exactly as it is supposed to be at this moment. Until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world, as on what needs to be changed in me and in my attitudes. Thank you. Thank you.